Aujourd'hui, nous sommes ravis d'accueillir un collègue local, Olivier Coquelin, que nous remercions pour sa présence et que nous avons hâte d'écouter. Et sans plus attendre, je laisse la parole à notre modérateur, Christophe Gillissen, que je remercie également pour sa présence parmi nous.
Merci Bertrand. Bonjour à toutes et à tous. Donc effectivement, pour cette séance inaugurale, nous avons le plaisir d'accueillir un invité que vous connaissez peut-être, sans doute, hein, puisque Olivier Coquelin est maître de conférence ici à l'Université de Caen-Normandie. Il est spécialiste d'études ou de civilisations britanniques et irlandaises au niveau de l'enseignement. Pour ce qui est de la recherche, elle porte avant tout sur l'histoire et l'idéologie des mouvements politiques et sociaux en Irlande sur une période assez large, puisqu'elle s'étend du XVIIIe au XXe siècle. Alors depuis un certain temps déjà, Olivier s'intéresse beaucoup à des mouvements sociaux, la dimension sociale de ce qu'on appelle parfois la révolution irlandaise, une révolution qui aurait débuté, selon les historiens, entre 1916 et entre 1912 et 1916, et qui s'est prolongée jusqu'en 1922-1923, une période qui a été beaucoup traité dans le cadre de centenaires successifs, hein, entre 2014 et 2023, la décennie des commémorations, comme on l'appelle en Irlande. Et donc l'aspect politique est bien connu, mais il reste beaucoup de choses à étudier, bien entendu. La dimension sociale l'est peut-être moins. Et là, à mon sens, Olivier apporte des éclairages tout à fait précieux. Par exemple, depuis quelque temps, il s'intéresse beaucoup à ces soviets, hein, dont on ne connaît pas toujours l'existence dans le contexte irlandais du début du XXe siècle. Parmi ces publications récentes, on peut signaler une monographie parue en 2018, intitulé « L'Irlande en révolution entre nationalisme et conservatisme », la co-direction d'un ouvrage collectif paru en 2022, intitulé « Northern Ireland, Challenges of Peace and Reconciliation since the Good Friday Agreement », un chapitre intitulé « Cleves Soviets, Socialism from Below in Revolutionary Ireland, 1920-1922 », un ouvrage collectif paru à Dublin en 2022 intitulé « Bread Not Profits, Provincial Working Class Politics During the Irish Revolution ». Et enfin, quel travail ces derniers temps. Et enfin, un article également paru en 2022 dans la revue Labour History Review, un article intitulé « A Strikers, Soviets in Belfast, The Great Belfast Strike of 1919 ». Donc, nous avons la chance d'avoir un vrai spécialiste ici qui, aujourd'hui, nous propose un sujet qui est dérivé de ses travaux antérieurs, mais qui est élargi, puisqu'il s'agit d'une communication intitulée « Soviets and Workers' Councils in Ireland and Europe, 1918-1923, a comparative study ». Donc, nous avons grande hâte de t'écouter à ce sujet et tu as la parole.
Ok, thank you very much, Christophe, and good afternoon, everyone. A few words first as a preamble, to point out that this paper is a longer version of the paper I delivered as part of a conference held in Dublin last September. As you know, the 4 years of the First World War, with their attendant violence, sacrifice, and untold suffering, gave way to a burning desire for a better world where pre-war conditions would no longer be the same. To achieve this, however, with not without trouble, as Europe experienced widespread social unrest, including general strikes, mass demonstrations, factory and farm occupations, etc. While many of the demands were not designed to overthrow the established order, but to improve the existing conditions through wage increases, shorter working weeks, transfer of agricultural property, etc., some movements had clearly revolutionary aims in the wake of Soviet Russia. Ireland was not immune to this phenomenon, which occurred at a time when the country was undergoing a major political revolution led by Sinn Féin and the Irish Republican Army with a view to independence. Thus, as part of an unprecedented strike movement for higher wages, 100 or so experiments in workers' self-management emerged, almost all under the name of Soviets, in this otherwise conservative, rural, and poorly industrialized island, plagued by centuries of political and ethno-religious conflicts. Sorry about that. So referring to the inspiration for the Irish workers' direct action, historian Emmett O'Connor points out, let's resume. So, as I've just said, referring to the inspiration for the Irish workers' direct action, historian Emmett O'Connor points out, quote, "A common explanation has been that the exploits of the IRA and the achievements of Sinn Féin provided the stimulus. However, the effect of this was not to provoke, but to enable workers to take action. More likely, the real inspiration was provided by contemporary events in Europe. The Russian Revolution, the factory occupation in Italy, the industrial unrest in Britain and Germany, and most of all by the way the victorious Allies turned the old world upside down in 1919, shaping a new Europe simply because they had the will and the power to do so," unquote. If credence is given to this latter assumption, the Irish Soviets would have sprung up in the wake of an international rather than a national subversive movement. So this paper sets out to review the European countries that experienced a Soviet or Workers' Council movement so as to divide them into sets based on how closely they adhered to the Russian model. This will ultimately enable us not only to determine the set into which Ireland might fall, but also to suggest some clues as to why Europe didn't move towards socialism in the first half of the 1920s. But before doing so, it is of course necessary to provide an overview of the so-called Irish Soviets. So, as mentioned earlier, the organization of a number of Irish workers into Soviets took place during the historical period known as the Irish Revolution, which some historians trace back to the 1912-14 Home Rule Crisis and others to the 1916 Easter Rising. Easter Rising, behind which were two main forces that took advantage of Britain's difficulties on the continent. On the one hand, the numerically stronger separatist movement, as represented by the Irish Volunteers, and on the other hand, the Labour movement, as embodied by socialist James Connolly's small battalion, the Irish Citizen Army. Although the 1916 rebellion didn't succeed in bringing down the British Empire, it gradually paved the way for the 1919-1921 War of Independence. Again, orchestrated by the Irish Volunteers, now called the Irish Republican Army, or IRA, and its political counterpart, Sinn Féin, which emerged victorious in Ireland in the December 1918 general election. The conflict officially ended in December 1921 with the signing of the Anglo-Irish Treaty, which, among other things, provided for the partition of Ireland into two distinct entities, that is, as you know, the Irish Free State and Northern Ireland. This led to a civil war within the pro-independence forces from 1922 to 1923, resulting in a victory for the supporters of the treaty. However, although the revolutionary nationalists exclusively aimed at Irish independence, which they hoped would unite the different social classes in accordance with their traditional cross-class approach to national liberation, many social disputes, both industrial and agrarian, gradually spread across the country from 1917 onwards. The strong growth in world demand for food and raw materials during the war had brought a certain domestic prosperity which mainly benefited industrial leaders, merchants, and large farmers. This at the expense of industrial and agricultural workers who then took advantage of the post-war economic boom to radically demand their fair share through an unequaled surge of strikes that overlapped with a resurgence of trade union militancy. However, in parallel with the traditional forms of struggle, an alternative organizational model called Soviet sprang up in Ireland, to which a certain number of workers resorted when strikes, negotiations, or other methods specific to the agricultural sector failed to obtain satisfaction of their demands. Named after the Russian councils, which had arisen during the 1917 revolution, this mode of action was based on the continuation or revival, the management or production of a given structure under the exclusive leadership of workers struggling against an official hierarchy who had previously been dismissed. This mode of action, therefore, fell under the heading of self-management or socialism from below, insofar as it was carried out by a rank-and-file movement acting mostly without, you know, regard to the union leadership. The self-management practices within these Soviets made them genuine subversive experiments comparable to the Russian factory committees through which workers had taken control of production in their work places, distinguishing them from the Soviet, strictly speaking, which were more focused on political issues. But in contrast to the Russian factory committees, the Irish Soviets also emerged in areas other than industrial and for purposes other than economic and social. This was the case in the agricultural sector and in various services, hospital, port and transport services to be more precise, as well as in a number of urban areas where the workers organized in Soviets pursued not socio-economic aims, not socio-economic, but socio-political aims. So the latter Soviets were therefore more akin to Russian Soviets, strictly speaking, and served as a kind of auxiliaries to the independence movement represented by the Irish Republican Army and Sinn Féin. This happened twice during the War of Independence. So for 2 days in April 1920, when many towns in the country came under the exclusive control of unionized workers, protesting against the conditions of detention of separatist prisoners who were on hunger strike in Mountjoy prison in Dublin. As a result, 87 political prisoners, members of Sinn Féin, were released and hospitalized following this massive mobilization, which saw the unions form ad hoc committees or councils to run local affairs in place of the official authorities. A year earlier, the city of Limerick had experienced a more or less similar fate when the Limerick Trades Council decided to set up a strike committee, which soon became known as the Soviet, after the city had been proclaimed a special military area by the British army in response to the escape of a Republican and trade unionist prisoner, Robert Byrne. Committees were then appointed to deal with propaganda, food, vigilance, and finance. Finally, their efforts bore fruit as the military authorities suspended martial law on the 6th of May 1918, that is 1 week after the strike had ended. However, more than any other factor, it was primarily socio-economic issues that prompted the establishment of Soviets, whether in industrial or agrarian conflicts or in the service sector, where one of the first Soviets was born barely a week after the outbreak of the War of Independence on the 25th of January 1919. 2 days later, then, the attendants and nurses at Monaghan Lunatic Asylum walked out to demand higher wages and better working conditions. On the 28th of January, rumors of police or military intervention to evacuate the occupied facility prompted the 100 or so strikers to take it over and run it independently of management. The employees barricaded the entrances, raised the red flag, formed a Soviet committee, and elected the local union delegate, Peter O'Donnell, as the asylum's director. But despite its radical and subversive flavor or nature, the movement was supported not only by the internees and the local population, but also by the clergy of all denominations, Sinn Féin and the Unionist, and even by the police, who were massively deployed around the building. After 7 days, the fear that this outpouring of sympathy would turn into a general strike led the official management to give in to all demands, thereby ending the Soviet experiment at Monaghan Asylum. Two other services also underwent a self-managing Soviet experiment. First, the Cork and Cove port services, which on the 6th of September 1921, from 10:30 a.m. to 4:30 p.m., came under the exclusive control of about 100 striking employees and workers before an agreement was reached guaranteeing the settlement of the wage dispute through arbitration. Then Cork County Railways, from the 10th to the 16th of February 1922, when, you know, several hundred railway workers who had been on strike since the 26th of January in protest at lower wages took over four stations and restarted the operation of the railways themselves until a compromise was reached. So, if the Cork Harbour Soviet appears to be the most ephemeral of all, it was in the agricultural sector that self-managed organizations were to break records for longevity, that is, nearly 10 months. As in Bradford, County Clare, from February 1922, into Vahira, Kilfenora, and Ballyvaughan, also in County Clare, probably from April 1922. In fact, each case was the product of farmers left behind by the 1903 and 1909 Land Acts, who wanted a fairer distribution of land and a drastic reduction in rents, which they imposed by seizing the management of the estates from the landowners and their agents. However, as the historian Fergus Campbell pointed out in 2005, the agrarian unrest that swept through the west of Ireland during the revolutionary period hasn't yet been examined in depth to assess its socially subversive character. An examination which, on the other hand, has already been given to the industrial disputes. So, other notable experiments in the industrial field included the Soviet, which the miners of Rychnow, County Leitrim, set up in May 1921 to restore production in one of the pits closed by the mining company's management after the miners refused to accept wage cuts. However, the miners eventually returned to the site after the dispute was resolved 2 months later. Then, in September of the same year, some 40 engineers at the Drogheda foundry, County Louth, also fighting against wage cuts, formed a Soviet at their workplace before being evicted by the police after 2 days. A similar fate awaited the Catherine Connell fishery workers in County Limerick in November 1921. Organized in the Soviet to obtain overtime pay, they finally won the case after being forced to negotiate at gunpoint by the IRA. The workers of the quarter town flour mill, County Cork, were less fortunate. On strike since the 13th of January 1922, in defense of wages, they decided to take over the factories and got the production machine going again until they were forced by the IRA to leave a week later, thereby causing the failure of the movement. Other Soviets that saw the intervention of the armed forces, in this case the National Army of the Irish Free State, were those of the Tipperary City Gas Works, established against the background of a wage dispute from March to August 1922, and of the Waterford City Gas Works from January to March 1923. But it was the southwestern dairy and bakery industry, controlled by the Clive Company, that the Soviet rebellion particularly affected. So, Clive is the name of a wealthy Protestant family who, during the revolutionary years, ran a network of over 100 creameries, flour mills, and condensed milk and bread factories in counties Limerick, Tipperary, and Cork. Their business had a workforce of nearly 3,000 and was supplied by around 5,000 grain and dairy farmers. From 1918 onwards, Clive, like many other companies across the country, experienced a number of industrial disputes over wages and working conditions. A number of them eventually turned into Soviet self-management experiments. First, from the 15th to the 21st of May 1920, in the Knocklong Creamery, County Limerick, and its 12 auxiliary branches in neighborhood localities, all of them handed back after the demands were met. Then, from the 15th of August to the 3rd of September 1921, in the brewery, mills, and bakery, County Limerick, which were returned to their owners, but not without IRA intercession. And finally, from May to July, August 1922, in virtually all the Clive factories and their auxiliary branches, which were gradually defeated by a combination of the boycotts of the grain and dairy farmers and the interference of the Irish Free State's National Army. So, at this stage, it is now possible to wonder why some Irish workers decided to pursue subversive methods to achieve what were essentially reformist goals. In attempting to answer this question, the testimony of one of the protagonists of the aforementioned Drogheda Soviet, as published by the Drogheda Independent, offers a most valuable contribution. So, on the 40th of September 1921, after a six-week strike against wage cuts, some 40 engineers at the Drogheda foundry resolved to take over their workplace and establish a self-managed Soviet before being dislodged by the police after 2 days. A week later, a reader of the Drogheda Independent caustically criticized the same engineers for seizing the foundry, not for themselves, but for the Drogheda workers. To this, the local secretary of the engineering union, Christy Burke, also involved in the Soviet, responded as follows. Quote, in last week's issue, Breyu, pseudonym of the reader, seems to be groping in the dark, or maybe the shoe pinches, but this letter is trying to construe the issue and fails miserably to find the interpretation of the word Soviet. He sits down in his office and gallops on the wrong course. His socialism, mine is Sovietism. Two distinct words and meaning as far as the Irish workers' point of view. He also declares that they seized the works for the workers of Drogheda, which statement I fully repudiate. We had no mandate from the Workers' Council to that effect. So, therefore, we could not act on their behalf, as, you know, Bragg Cryu tries to make it appear to those ignorant of the Irish Soviets' methods or why the Irish Soviets were seized at all. Why did the iron workers seize the works? To prove to the engineering world that the proprietors could advance the wages of the workers concerned instead of reducing them and still have a very big profit. Why were the proprietors so anxious to put us off the premises? Because we would prove it so, unquote. The Soviet was therefore conceived as a temporary but also democratic takeover of the management and production of their company, allowing them to prove that their demands were relevant and could be implemented successfully. This was essentially the way Irish Soviets operated, at least until 1921, as a means of pressuring employers or political authorities to give in to the strikers' demands. The invariable consequence was that, whatever the outcome of the conflicts, life in the workplaces or in the urban areas returned to normal without any radical change in the relations of the existing economic or political order. But while for most of the protagonists of the Soviets, the aim was not to promote a socialist revolution, many of them didn't hesitate to display socially subversive symbols. That's it. So, starting with the term Soviet, okay, which some, you know, spontaneously gave themselves, but also the red flags, which, you know, were raised on some of the occupied workplaces, or openly anti-capitalist slogans such as brewery workers' Soviet mills, we make bread, not profits, printed on the front door of the brewery factory in 1921. A famous picture of which can be seen here on the screen, and this is also the picture illustrating the poster of today's seminar. However, the post-war economic boom gave way to a slump from the mid-1920s. Social unrest in Ireland gradually grew into struggles against the wage cuts that employers and farmers were imposing. The balance of power shifted in favor of the latter, so much so that, as Emmett O'Connor puts it, Labour was coming close to conceding what had been won since 1914, end quotes. This also meant that, unlike the Soviet setup in the period 1919-21, whose original goals had been achieved, all of the 1922-23 Soviets ended in total failure. Class struggle had thus escalated, especially from July 1921, when the War of Independence came to an end, reaching its climax, in particular with the Kliev Soviets of May-August 1922. So here, the unprecedented scale of seizures and takeovers made the challenge to property rights more deeply felt than in the previous Soviets. Employers and farmers, therefore, launched a most aggressive counter-offensive through their respective organizations, supported by the Irish Free State government and National Army, in line with what Emmett O'Connor calls the conservative response to social disorder in a civil war context. Not to mention the official union and labor leaders whose refusal to use subversive methods to achieve their revolutionary aims naturally led them to disregard, you know, the Soviets displaying any subversive inclination. So, the defeats that punctuated this period left many workers disillusioned, resulting, you know, in a decline in the membership of the unions, particularly the largest of them, the Irish Transport and General Workers Union. This undoubtedly helped, you know, to reinforce the domination of the various conservative forces in the Irish Free State, aided not only by the Catholic Church, but also, at least indirectly, by the union and labor leaders who refused to countenance direct action and were to gradually abandon the syndicalist doctrine of the one big union, embracing, you know, a reformist and legalistic line that was more consistent with the paradigms of the new Irish Free States. Okay, so I will now take a comparative look at the Soviet and Workers' Council movements that emerged in certain European countries and regions in the aftermath of the First World War. And as I said in the introduction, I will use the Russian model as a comparative common thread. Starting with the particular case of Ukraine, particular in that paradoxically it was Lenin's government that drew its inspiration to a certain extent from an ideological model that was not Bolshevik, but libertarian communist or anarcho-communist as regards its agricultural policy in Ukraine in 1918-20. So, as you know, Ukraine was part of the Russian Empire when the revolution of February 1917 broke out. In June of the same year, Ukraine proclaimed its autonomy, followed by full independence in November. In the meantime, revolutionary activists such as Lenin and Trotsky had returned from exile, while others had been released from prison, such as the Ukrainian anarchist Nestor Makhno, who was to play a major role in the events that followed. Back in his hometown of Huliapol, Makhno resumed his militant activities and quickly became a major figure in the local revolutionary movement. A peasant himself, he encouraged poor peasants to form free communes on the large estates confiscated from local landowners from autumn 1917. Aware that not everyone in the peasantry shared his collectivist approach to agricultural work, he also advocated a fair redistribution of land based on the principle that land should belong to those who work on it, which also encompassed the former large landowners, if they so wished, of course. However, so this is here to illustrate, you know, you can see here a picture of Makhno wearing his, you know, very famous Cossack uniform. However, following the Treaty of Brest-Litovsk, Ukraine officially came under Austro-German control in March 1918. Makhno then organized resistance to the occupation by the Austro-German armies, which deported the Ukrainian nationalists. Nevertheless, he had to leave Ukraine, and in the course of his wanderings, he met Lenin in Moscow on the 25th of June 1918. And during this meeting, the two men notably talked about the free agricultural communes of Ukraine, Makhno telling Lenin that almost all of them had been created by anarcho-communists. And this undoubtedly struck a chord with Lenin, as a week later, the Council of People's Commissars released 10 million rubles in aid to the Ukrainian communes. And so Bolshevik support for the creation of agricultural communes in summer 1918 increased the number from 242 in June to 1,384 in December. These communes operated on the principles of solidarity, equality, and self-management, and comprised between 100 and 300 individuals. Decisions were taken democratically at the General Assembly, where everyone could express their opinions. The land was worked collectively. Cooking and dining facilities were shared, and education for children and parents was also provided. So, as we saw earlier, Ireland also experienced this kind of collective self-management practice in the agricultural sector, in this case undertaken by farmers who had benefited little or not at all from the 1903 and 1909 Land Acts. Unlike the Ukrainian communards, however, their main aim was to improve the distribution of land or drastically reduce rents rather than to collectivize the land, strictly speaking. This was particularly true in the village of Broadfoot, County Clare, mentioned earlier, where, you know, in February 1922, tenant farmers seized the estates of their landlord, James Denison Going, in order to obtain full satisfaction of their demands. And to this end, a committee of farmers, tenants, workers, and transport union workers on the Going estates was formed, with one of its members elected as its secretary. The new committee, or you know, Soviet, did not expropriate the landlord's estates and actually paid the rents for several months, but on its own terms. In addition, they converted some of the land into common grazing land, leased plots to Broadfoot's landless peasants, appointed supervisors over the herds and maintained the fences, and expelled employees who refused to comply with the Soviets' demands. So, as in the other Irish Soviets, the protagonist of the Broadfoot Soviet, therefore, sought to demonstrate that their demands were valid and could be successfully put into practice. In other words, there was no question of overthrowing the socio-economic order on a Bolshevik basis, for example, in the form of a cooperative form, and even less on an anarcho-communist basis, as in Ukraine. And so, in Ukraine, things began to change from 1919 onwards, when the agricultural communes were gradually abandoned by both the Magnovists and the Bolsheviks. The main reason for this was that the small and medium-sized landowners in the villages took a dim view of these communes run by poor peasants. And so, in order not to lose the support of the section of the peasantry in this time of civil war, the Magnovists and then the Bolsheviks began, you know, to encourage the fair redistribution of land rather than its collectivization. Thereafter, the communes would survive as best they could throughout the 1920s before disappearing for good in 1935 to the benefit of Kolkhozes and Sovkhozes. As for Makhno, at the head of an army of peasants, not all of whom were anarchists, and also known as the Makhnovichina, he actually fought on several occasions alongside the Red Army against their common enemies, and in particular the white counter-revolutionaries, until his army's crushing defeat against that same Red Army in 1921. Makhno then had no choice but to flee Ukraine with his family and lived out the rest of his days in extreme poverty in Paris, where he died of tuberculosis in 1934. Okay, so we will now briefly look at the European countries that were, you know, more or less inspired by the Bolshevik model when it was applied on a greater or lesser scale and for a longer or shorter period. So, starting with Hungary, which had a council regime throughout its territory for 7 months in 1919. And this, you know, therefore, you know, makes it, you know, a far cry from the Soviet experience in Ireland, of course. As you know, the end of the Great War saw the breakup of the Austro-Hungarian Empire, giving rise to a republic in Hungary in November 1918. However, the coalition in power, comprising, you know, independentists and social democrats, had great difficulty in handling the various social unrest affecting the country at the time, notably through the creation of workers' councils, which took control of many factories and businesses, and of several provincial towns. Faced with an ultimatum from the Entente countries, the war victors, so concerning Hungary's new borders, the government preferred to resign, leaving the way clear for belligerent communists, increasingly popular with the population, to seize power with the social democrats and proclaim the Hungarian Republic of Councils at the same time as the merger of the two parties, that is, on the 21st of March 1919. However, this council regime, which officially established the dictatorship of the proletariat and nationalized means of production, only lasted a few months and came to an end on the 1st of August 1919 as a result of a combination of external and internal factors. External factors first, which included military pressure from the Entente countries, which wanted, you know, to impose the terms of Hungary over its new borders. And this, you know, led to armed conflicts with Romania, Yugoslavia and Czechoslovakia, supported by France, but with no involvement of Soviet Russia. Internal factors, as for them, included the onslaught of counter-revolutionary forces aided by the Entente, an ill-prepared and demoralized Hungarian Red Army, economic problems mainly due to armed conflicts, the indifference of the peasants' masses following the government's refusal to divide up the large estates into small holdings, and Paradoxically, the lack of firm support for the government's policy of the workers' councils, which, it is true, were predominantly social democratic. And this, although, you know, the new republic had been proclaimed in their name in March 1919. So here you can see a picture of Belakon, the communist leader of the Hungarian Republic of Councils. It was also during the period of the Hungarian Soviet regime that two other countries in the former Austro-Hungarian Empire were to experience a Soviet-like upheaval. As in Slovakia, incorporated in Czechoslovakia, in October 1918, where a republic of councils were proclaimed on the 16th of June 1919, following the invasion of part of the country by the Hungarian Red Army with a view to re-establishing Hungary's former borders. But this short-lived Slovak Republic of Councils, created mainly by Hungarian communists, was not to survive the demise of its Hungarian counterpart on the 1st of August 1919. So here we have a map of the Slovak and Hungarian Council Republics, in which you can note that only part of Slovakia was under a communist rule. So the other main component of the former Austro-Hungarian Empire, Austria, also saw the development of workers' councils in factories in most cities following the establishment of the Republic of German Austria on the 12th of November 1918. However, under the influence of the ruling Social Democratic Party and after the failed putsch attempt by the Viennese communist in June 1919, these councils were stripped of their political content and gradually transformed into co-management bodies that didn't challenge the foundations of the capitalist system. This was actually in line with the strategy of slow revolution as theorized by the social democratic leader Otto Bauer. Okay, so here to illustrate, you can see a picture of the repression of the attempted communist putsch in Vienna in June 1919. So the other central empire, the German Empire, actually underwent a more or less similar fate after the war with the establishment of the so-called Weimar Republic on the 9th November 1918. And this following the creation of workers' and soldiers' councils in a number of cities and towns in the country, which subsequently spread to the whole of Germany. Here too, however, these councils were to lose their political substance under the influence of the ruling Social Democrats, who controlled most of them. The gradual advent of socialism that the Social Democrats were calling for even led them to suppress the Spartacist uprising of January 1919. As a result of which, you know, the workers' and soldiers' councils set up in November 1918 were also forcibly dismantled. The same was true of the Bavarian Republic of Councils, proclaimed by Social Democrats on the 7th of April 1919, but after a few days led in a revolutionary fashion by communists until it was finally crushed on the 3rd of May by the far-right militia, the Freikorps, used by the Social Democratic government to wipe out the country's workers and soldiers' councils. So here you can see we have a picture of the Reich Congress of Workers' and Soldiers' Councils held in the Prussian Landtag in Berlin on the 16th of December 1916, so just after the so-called German Revolution. So in this connection, it is also worth mentioning the other territory of the former German Empire, which experienced a council revolution, that is Alsace-Lorraine, before officially returning to its original French bosom. In fact, from the 9th to the 25th of November 1918, that is during the transitional period, Alsatian and Lorraine sailors from the German army and local workers took over 24 urban areas in Alsace-Lorraine, including Strasbourg, and set up workers' and soldiers' councils to manage day-to-day affairs such as transport, finance, and food supplies in place of the official authorities. A bit like, you know, what the Limerick Soviets would do a few months later in April 1919. But the arrival of French troops finally put an end to the short-lived council revolution in Alsace-Lorraine. So here is a map of the workers' councils set up and established in Alsace-Lorraine for 2 weeks in November 1918. Finally, one last continental European country that saw the development of a council movement was Italy during the so-called Biennio Rosso, that is the two red years of 1918-1920. This period actually took place against a backdrop of economic and political crisis in the wake of the Great War. It was marked by occupations of large estates by peasants in the center and south of the country, major workers' demonstrations, a large number of strikes for higher wages, and violent clashes with the police and between rival militias. And when conventional strikes were not enough, workers resorted to factory occupations in the industrialized north, many of which were transformed into workers' councils that took over the running of production, as also happened in Ireland from late 1918 onwards. This was the case at the Fiat factories in Turin, where, you know, in September 1920, delegates were elected to coordinate production, while others were elected for the defense of the plants through armed workers' militias known as the Red Guards. The Fiat Factory Council even announced that it wanted to establish trade relations with Soviet Russia and sell cars there. So the immediate revolutionary aims of the workers' councils were therefore quite clear, which distinguished them from the Irish Soviets, at least in this respect. However, many in the leadership of the Italian Socialist Party and the country's main trade union, the General Confederation of Labour, were opposed to extending the movement to the rest of the country. The General Confederation of Labour therefore preferred to negotiate an agreement with the employers whereby the factories would be evacuated peacefully in exchange for the wage increases demanded and the promise of workers' control over the management of the companies, a promise which was, you know, actually never kept. This agreement eventually sounded the death knell of the Italian council movement, in that, you know, left on their own and disillusioned, the striking workers had no choice but to return the factories they had occupied and managed. So, here too, the majority of socialist and trade union leaders had a reformist vision whereby the advance of socialism could only be achieved gradually. But this reformist vision conflicted with the aims of a section of the rank and file, has happened in Ireland too, at least to a certain extent, especially in 1922-23, when class struggle escalated. Sorry about that. Yes, so now to illustrate what has just been said, we have here a picture of red, of Italian Red Guards posing, you know, outside Turin factory in September 1920. Finally, before concluding, before moving on to the conclusion, the general conclusion, and in order to be as comprehensive as possible, I will just mention very briefly the cases of Great Britain, Finland, and Bulgaria, each of them also having experienced a more or less revolutionary situation, but this time without involving council movements in the strict sense. In Britain, to begin with, where a shop stewards movement was launched as, you know, early as 1915, first in Scotland with the Clyde Workers Committee, then in all the island's industrial centres from 1917 until the early month of 1919. However, although this movement was, you know, initially intended to lay the foundations for a genuine workers' council movement, it never went beyond the stage of strike councils, operating regardless of a very legalistic official union leadership, with a view to obtaining wage increases, more trade union rights, and reductions in working hours. Then Finland, a few words on Finland, which gained its independence in December 1917, after having, you know, been part of the Russian Empire as an autonomous Grand Duchy for 108 years. So then a period of transition followed, which led to a civil war from January to May 1918 between the Social Democratic Red Guards, supported by Soviet Russia, and the White Guards, led by the country's conservative Senate and backed by Germany. The country was thus divided into two entities, each under the domination of one of the two warring camps. Nevertheless, during its five-month existence, so-called Red Finland didn't rest on the Soviet movement, unlike revolutionary Russia. And it finally collapsed after the defeat of its armies in May 1918. A final word now on Bulgaria, to say that a quickly suppressed communist insurrection was launched against the right-wing bloc government in September 1923, but without a Soviet wave sweeping through the country beforehand, as in, you know, Austria. A right-wing bloc, which, it should be noted, had itself come to power following a putsch orchestrated in June 1923. So, in conclusion, now, can be said that, yes, the Irish Soviets were, I mean, indeed, part of the European subversive movement, more or less inspired by the Russian Revolution of 1917 and Bolshevism, with the exception of Ukraine, at least to a certain extent. While there were, you know, some disparities between each country, these movements, nonetheless, shared a number of common features. For example, it seems, you know, possible to include Ireland and Italy in the same subset, the two cases being quite similar in many respects. For other countries, on the other hand, what they had in common was, among other things, that their respective conservative counter-offensives led in the shorter or longer term to the establishment of fascist or fascistic regimes, as in Hungary, Italy, Germany and Austria. So the question we can ask ourselves now is, what were the reasons that prevented the advent of the socialist revolution in post-First World War Europe, where the situation was clearly revolutionary? Of course, I won't have time here to list all the possible reasons, so I will just mention one of them. For example, we can ask ourselves whether the dichotomy between socialism from below and socialism from above, of which the Irish and the other European Council movements were in a way victims, and which is characterized not by the opposition between reform and revolution, but between a vision of socialism originating from the rank and file and a vision imposed by a ruling elite, whether reformist or revolutionary. So whether this dichotomy was not a major factor in the failure of the European-wide socialist revolution that the Russian Bolsheviks were calling for. Thank you very much for your attention.
Thank you, Olivier. A wide-ranging paper, you know, you covered many countries, and that helps to understand the extent of the turmoil in Europe after the First World War, and the possibilities that were open, and some of them were closed fairly quickly. But it's interesting to see, this. These Soviets or these councils appearing, simultaneously in so many countries. I don't know if there are any reactions, questions, remarks in French or in English, whichever when you feel more at ease in. On peut faire ça en français, on peut faire ça en anglais.
Oui, absolument.
En russe.
En russe,
ukrainien. Mathieu en russe, voilà.
Ça risque d'être un monologue, en tout cas, j'aurais du mal à suivre. J'avais peut-être, par rapport à la dimension irlandaise, un certain nombre de choses qui m'ont intrigué, notamment l'attitude de l'IRA par rapport à ces conseils ou ces soviets. Si j'ai bien compris, dans certains cas, ils ont mis un terme à l'occupation d'une usine, etc. Dans d'autres cas, ils ont contraint tout le monde à se réunir, à négocier. C'était le cas à l'Emeuk, je crois, hein, les ouvriers dans... Oui, c'est ça, oui. Et donc, est-ce que c'était purement par pragmatisme, comment débloquer une situation, ou est-ce qu'il y avait une position... disons, davantage politique, est-ce qu'ils étaient plutôt favorables ou plutôt hostiles sur le fond ?
Alors, en fait, ça s'inscrivait dans, comme je l'ai précisé, hein, du reste, ça s'inscrivait dans la tradition du mouvement républicain irlandais, qui se voulait interclassiste, en fait. Donc, tout ce qui empiétait, tout ce qui allait à l'encontre, tout ce qui faisait obstacle au but suprême qui était l'indépendance devait être éradiqué. Donc je pense qu'il y avait la crainte quand même que le peuple irlandais dans son ensemble, donc la classe ouvrière incluse, soit dévié, si je puis dire, du but ultime par des considérations plus socio-économiques. Mmh. Donc c'est ce qui a fait qu'en effet, ils ont fait en sorte que les conflits sociaux se règlent à l'amiable, et quand cela ne se produisait pas, ils utilisaient la menace physique. Et ce qui peut paraître, je ne l'ai pas évoqué ici, mais ce qui peut paraître paradoxal, de par son engagement antérieur, c'est que Constance Markievicz, qui a été un moment donc, ministre du Travail, hein, du gouvernement clandestin, c'est elle qui, justement, d'après certains témoignages, qui auraient menacé d'utiliser les armes de l'IRA si, certains ouvriers... Oui, c'était à Limerick, hein, donc la poissonnerie de Limerick, enfin, l'usine ou la poissonnerie, je ne sais plus comment on dit ça. Conserverie, oui, plutôt, oui. Voilà. S'ils n'évacuaient pas les lieux. Voilà. Donc, Constance Markievicz, qui était quand même aux côtés de James Connolly pendant la rébellion de Pâques. Donc, c'était une des dirigeantes hein, de la milice ouvrière qui avait pour nom donc, l'Irish Citizen Army. Mmh.
Cela étant, Connolly lui-même, hein, ce dirigeant syndicaliste, très impliqué dans la Irish Citizen Army, dans les lockouts de 1916, s'il rejoint les dirigeants du soulèvement de Pâques 1916, c'est qu'il accepte de mettre temporairement de côté, en se disant que la révolution politique, l'indépendance, permettra des réformes ou des changements profonds au niveau social et économique. Donc, ça aurait été validé aussi par lui, d'une certaine manière
ou... On ne peut pas savoir. Hein. Ça reste... Oui, ça fait débat. Hein. Ça fait débat. Hein. Beaucoup, d'ailleurs, dénigrent, en fait, enfin, critiquent sa participation, ne comprennent pas, tout simplement, sa participation au soulèvement de Pâques 1916, aux côtés, justement, des nationalistes purs et durs, hein, qui, eux, avaient donc une vision interclassiste de la lutte de la libération, enfin de la lutte pour la libération nationale, quoi. Alors, par contre, peu de temps avant la rébellion de Pâques, il ne faut pas oublier que Connolly, bon, qui était quand même assez optimiste, hein, il pensait bon, que ça allait aboutir, hein, mais il a prévenu donc, les activistes de l'Irish Citizen Army, donc il leur a fortement conseillé de conserver leurs armes après la révolution nationale, car il avait éventuellement envisagé une guerre civile, justement. Parce qu'il disait, ceux avec qui on s'allie aujourd'hui n'auront peut-être pas demain les mêmes objectifs. Donc gardez vos armes, vos fusils, précieusement. Donc c'est pour ça, c'est un débat, en effet. Hein. Qu'aurait fait Connolly, il y a des arguments hein, qui tiennent la route des deux côtés, je pense.
Oui, ouais, très bien.
Et depuis cette date de 1923, durant les 100 dernières années, est-ce qu'il y a eu d'autres mouvements sociaux semblables, généralisés sur tout le territoire européen ?
Ah, sur tout le territoire européen, je croyais que tu allais parler de l'Irlande.
Oui, de l'Irlande, mais ailleurs aussi.
Il y a eu aussi, en 1956... La rébellion ou la révolution avortée hein, en Hongrie, où justement des ouvriers se sont emparés de la gestion et de la production de leurs usines. Donc il y a eu des expériences un peu similaires. Donc on était revenu au concept de soviet, mais originel, en fait. Hein. Ça a contribué évidemment, ce n'était pas la seule raison, mais à l'intervention qu'on connaît hein, des chars soviétiques. Hein. Oui, 56, bon après, il y a eu des expériences. D'autogestion ouvrière un peu partout. Hein. En France, on a connu le fameux cas de l'IP, dont on fête les 50 ans. On a fêté les 50 ans aujourd'hui, cette année. Et du reste, Charles Piaget, qui était le leader, justement, de ce mouvement-là, est décédé il y a 3 jours. J'ai appris ça en écoutant France Culture il n'y a pas longtemps. Donc, parce que là, ça relève, le terme soviet, évidemment, prête un peu, peut-être à confusion, mais ça relève de l'expérience d'autogestion, hein, qu'on retrouve aujourd'hui, par exemple, dans les SCOP. Ces entreprises-là fonctionnent sur un mode autogestionnaire, où justement les dirigeants sont élus démocratiquement, où il y a des assemblées, où tout le monde a voix au chapitre, peut donner son avis, son point de vue, et il y a des votes fréquents. En fait, c'est ce qui s'est produit en Irlande et partout ailleurs hein, à cette époque-là, entre 1918 et puis 1923. Quoi. Mais sur une grande échelle, c'est peut-être ça ta question, sur une grande échelle peut-être. Oui, moi je ne connais que le cas de la Hongrie, hein, je pense, en 1956, pendant quelques mois avant l'intervention des chars soviétiques, peut-être en Tchécoslovaquie aussi.
Ces actions.
Ah c'était un mouvement spontané. Hein. Ça fait, comment dire, je ne sais pas si c'est la bonne expression, une traînée de poudre. Enfin, je veux dire, après tout le monde a su.
Oui. Tout le monde a suivi un peu le mouvement, quoi. Je pense que ce qui s'est passé en Hongrie, c'est que ça a commencé par deux, trois entreprises, et après, ça s'est répandu, hein, la nouvelle s'est répandue dans tout le pays, et puis voilà, donc les ouvriers se sont emparés de la gestion de la production sur leur lieu de travail, quoi.
Alors moi, il y a un épisode, je me suis retenu, je n'ai pas ri, mais j'ai trouvé ça absolument fabuleux. Lorsque cet asile de lunatiques, si on traduit littéralement cet asile de fous, hein, se lance dans l'autogestion avec le soutien de patients. Alors là, je me dis que les archives, ça va être absolument fabuleux à consulter. Mais plus sérieusement, j'étais un peu surpris d'apprendre que le clergé a soutenu cette expérimentation, alors que le fait de hisser le drapeau rouge, c'est un peu comme agiter un chiffon rouge.
Exactement. Dire, hein.
Et alors, je veux savoir si éventuellement, tu te souviens de quelques détails de...
Je n'ai pas encore bien étudié cette expérience-là. Donc, il n'a pas donné lieu à la publication d'articles encore ou de communication. Oui, moi, ça m'intrigue un peu pour savoir pourquoi ça a fait l'unanimité. J'ai précisé aussi les unionistes.
Absolument.
Et le Sinn Féin, la police. Mais tout le monde était derrière ce mouvement-là. C'était quand même assez hallucinant, quoi. Ça a fait vraiment l'unanimité. Et du coup, la direction a tout cédé, quoi. Voilà. C'était ça, ou alors je ne sais quoi, parce que de toute façon, ça ne pouvait pas tenir. Je veux dire, une expérience comme ça, seule, ça peut, enfin, je ne pense pas, hein, ça peut pas être viable. Je ne pense pas. Parce que c'est quand même illégal, c'est quand même un mouvement subversif, quoi. On subvertit quand même son lieu de travail, quoi. Donc, à un moment, je pense que l'armée serait intervenue. C'est ce qu'on peut penser, quoi.
C'est en 1919, pendant la guerre anglo-irlandaise.
Ouais, c'était tout au début. Tout au début. De par le caractère vraiment illégal, quoi. Une atteinte à la propriété privée, au droit de propriété privée, tout ça. Donc je pense que, in fine, les forces armées seraient intervenues, je pense. Alors après, que serait-il advenu ? Est-ce que l'IRA aurait pris fait et cause, aurait défendu cette expérience-là ? Je ne sais pas. Alors, pour parler de l'IRA, pour revenir un peu sur l'IRA, j'ai mentionné à un moment donc, la mine de Regna dans le comté de Leitrim. Alors, ce qu'il faut savoir, c'est que c'est celui qui était à la tête de ce mouvement-là était membre de l'IRA aussi. Donc, il y a quand même des membres de l'IRA qui ont participé à certaines de ces expériences autogestionnaires. Il y avait des membres de l'IRA qui étaient membres de l'Irish Transport and General Workers Union, qui était vraiment le gros syndicat irlandais à l'époque. Peter O'Donnell, justement, qui était élu directeur de l'asile d'aliénés. À l'époque, il n'était pas encore un membre de l'IRA, mais il allait adhérer à l'IRA par la suite. Il allait incarner cette tendance minoritaire au sein du mouvement républicain, à la suite, dans la lignée de James Connolly, donc aspirant à combiner lutte sociale et lutte politique, quoi. Donc, l'une des têtes pensantes, on va dire, de ce qu'on a appelé le socialisme républicain, quoi. Ben alors,
mais oui, par rapport à la chronologie, on voit que ça apparaît à peu près partout au même moment, et nulle part ça ne parvient à s'enraciner ou à durer. Hein.
Dans le comté de Clare, là où il y a eu des Land Soviets, ça a duré quand même quelques mois. Oui. Il y a eu des cas où ça a duré 6 mois aussi. Hein, justement, les usines à gaz, c'est à Waterford, je crois que ça a duré 6 mois. Je ne sais plus si c'est Tipperary Town ou bien Waterford. Non, ça a duré quand même, ça a duré assez longtemps dans certains cas. Ça a duré d'une seule journée, donc c'est le port de Cork, ça a duré donc de 10h30 le matin jusqu'à 4h30. Tout a été réglé, mais pendant ce laps de temps-là, donc, les ouvriers ont continué quand même, à faire marcher donc l'entreprise, enfin, faire en sorte que ça fonctionne toujours, jusqu'à une dizaine de mois, quoi, dans le comté de Clare. Donc c'était assez variable. C'est pour ça que c'est assez riche. Hein. Ça peut être analysé de diverses manières.
Absolument. En fait. Oui, il y a beaucoup de cas particuliers, mais là, je pensais à la chronologie à l'échelle de l'Europe. Justement, ouais. Il y a une sorte de faille, de fenêtre de tir, je ne sais pas exactement comment décrire ça, mais qui se referme assez vite, hein, pour toutes sortes de raisons. Que tu
as oui.
Même si ça peut apparaître...
Sporadiquement, on peut dire que l'Irlande tient lieu un peu de... dernier des Mohicans, quoi, pour ce qui est du mouvement de conseil, hein, ou de soviet, hein, parce que je pense que ça s'arrête en Italie en 1920, quoi, avec le Biennio Rosso. Quoi.
C'est ça.
Ouais.
C'est ça. Ouais.
Après, non, en Autriche, c'est pareil. C'est... Ouais, ça s'arrête en 1920 en Europe, et puis ça continue encore en Irlande. Justement, pendant... de mai à août 1922, il y a quand même l'ensemble des usines de l'entreprise Clive qui a fonctionné sous l'égide justement du drapeau rouge. C'était quasiment un empire industriel et commercial. Donc les autorités politiques comme économiques ont eu vraiment peur. Et ça, c'est pour ça que j'en ai parlé, ça a généré donc une contre-offensive des plus agressives. Des agriculteurs et aussi de l'ensemble du patronat et puis des autorités aussi républicaines qui étaient en place à l'époque.
Et les ouvriers d'usine en grève demandaient de meilleures conditions de travail. Sur quoi portaient leurs revendications exactement? Sur quel domaine de leur vie professionnelle, c'était les
salaires essentiellement.
Oui, aussi.
Oui, ça peut être ça. Les conditions de travail, conditions de travail au sens large, mais surtout les salaires. C'est vraiment ce qu'on a appelé le mouvement des salaires. Hein, justement, Emmett O'Connor, qui est vraiment le grand spécialiste du mouvement ouvrier, que je cite à plusieurs reprises, le grand spécialiste du mouvement ouvrier, justement, lui a utilisé cette expression-là, le mouvement des salaires. En Irlande, qui vraiment prend une dimension importante à partir de 1919, quoi, pendant la guerre d'indépendance. Quoi. Même jusqu'à... Bon, après, évidemment, il y a aussi la récession qui se fait ressentir en Irlande en 1921. Et donc là, comme je l'ai précisé, donc là, on se bat plus, on ne fait plus grève pour des augmentations de salaire, mais pour lutter, c'est plus défensif. C'est plus défensif, donc c'est pour lutter contre les baisses de salaire que souhaitait justement imposer l'ensemble du patronat. Justement.
C'était des usines où travaillaient des hommes ou est-ce qu'il y avait des femmes aussi?
Oui, il y avait des femmes aussi. Hein, dans les creameries et bakery factories, il y avait des femmes aussi. Oui.
Non, vous n'avez pas de questions. Tu as employé le mot boycott, qui n'est pas un hasard non plus dans un contexte irlandais.
Oui, mais c'est du coup un peu anachronique, hein, parce que Captain Boycott, c'était à l'époque de la Land War, donc les années 1870-1880. Mais c'est un terme qui a son origine en Irlande, en effet.
Bon, bah écoutez, je propose que l'on remercie Olivier Coquelin pour cette communication.